Well, it's a pleasure and a privilege today to talk about a wonderful new book called The World of Aufbau by Peter Schrag. Peter is one of the America's distinguished journalists. He's a graduate of Amherst College in the class of 1953, and he returned to Amherst a few years after graduation to run a large section of the publications office of Amherst, including the Amherst News Bureau. So he was already on his way at that point in his life to becoming a journalist, and pursued that over a period of many, many years, which led him to an editorship at the Saturday Review, one of the great magazines of the 20th century, and also to teaching at Berkeley and to serving as editorial page editor for a long time of the Sacramento Bee, one of the most important American newspapers. He's also been a lecturer, a researcher, and is the author of at least half a dozen books, of which The World of Aufbau is only the most recent. Some of the other titles are The Decline of the Wasp, The End of the American Future, and Test of Loyalty. Many of these have great resonance to issues going on today, and so I think is The World of Aufbau. Peter, why don't you tell us what Aufbau is or was?
Aufbau was for about 70 years a weekly newspaper in German, addressed primarily, obviously, to German-speaking refugees from Hitler, and it covered everything of any interest, from the most mundane things about immigration laws, procedures, alien registration, naturalization procedures, to how the New York City subways worked, landmarks in New York to visit, and then to major issues, obviously the goings-on in Europe, anti-Semitism in America, a lot about, obviously, about Zionism, which Aufbau strongly supported, creation of a national home for Jews, which became Israel, restitution by the German government for repairs, compensation for refugees for all the things that they lost or were stolen from them. So it covered just about everything. Obviously, always had a little bit of or more than a little bit of a global outlook about the world. So it was a fascinating look at that whole generation of German-speaking immigrants, and not only German-speaking, obviously, because Aufbau was in German, social lives, lots of ads for everything you can think of, tailors, jewelers, dry cleaners, every sort of commodity you could think of, every sort of service you could think of, lots of restaurants advertised, and of course in the Upper West Side, which is where, on the West Side, in general in Manhattan, there was a great concentration of Hitler refugees, German-speaking. They created a lot of synagogues, a lot of shuls, and of course that was another interest of Aufbau, was the status of jewelry in America. Ran lots of announcements of synagogue services, and maybe most important, as I look back on it now, was that both before the war and to some extent during the war, and then in great extent after the war, when the camps were liberated, lots of personal ads of people looking for loved ones, both ways. Camp survivors looking for loved ones elsewhere, and refugees, immigrants in America and elsewhere in the world, looking for loved ones who might have survived the camps. Hundreds and hundreds of them.
So we're living in a world in which many, many smaller newspapers are disappearing very, very rapidly. But the Aufbau disappeared for reasons different from those that are being eliminated because of the Internet. The Aufbau seems to have disappeared because its audience morphed into something other than it had been at the time of the height of the newspaper.
That's right. It was created, it was originally a newsletter for the German Jewish Club, later called the New World Club, in New York. And by the way, there were obviously great clusters of Hitler refugees elsewhere, many in California. But anyway, it started as a newsletter of the German Jewish Club in New York, grew increasingly into a pretty much independent weekly tabloid newspaper serving that audience. And obviously, as they assimilated, and as they became, and as their children were born and grew up, there was less and less of a market for what Aufbau had provided. It was a measure of its success, you might say. It basically succeeded into its own extinction. But it lasted just about 70 years from the early 1934, roughly, until and its last issue was, I think, in 2004. But it had pretty much, that was a ghost of what it had been. So I'd say its heyday was from roughly the mid-30s to the mid-80s.
So Americanization was one of the big goals of the newspaper, teaching German Jewish refugees how not to be aliens. But
that's right.
The measure of its success was, I gather, that once the German Jews were no longer aliens, they no longer needed that newspaper.
That's absolutely correct. My favorite little item of that was a little ad that was run by a clothing store in New York. And the line was, "Americanize yourself, also your wardrobe."
Well, one of my favorite passages in the book, and there are many, is your description of the restaurants on the Upper West Side where people went for café and so forth. And I was thinking, as in remembering my own wanderings around the Upper West Side in more recent times, that not one of those remains, which is both a testament to the fact that Frankfurt on the Hudson no longer exists, but also of the fact that New York is a place that is constantly morphing from one thing into many other things.
As it has been through its history, and you're absolutely right, all those places now are occupied. If they're still restaurants, they're now Latino or whatever. And obviously the predominant foreign language or non-English language spoken in that area is Spanish.
And to change the subject just a little bit, I think one of the great things about your book is that while it is the history of a newspaper, a subject which is of tremendous interest in general in American cultural history, but also particularly in the history of journalism, you treat that newspaper not in isolation, but as a window on the entire history of a refugee community in America in a very, very troubled and tragic period. And through the eyes of the Aufbau, in your work, we come to see this population of German Jewish refugees in its great variety as it expands and adjusts to life in the United States. So I think your work has tremendous resonance to what's going on in our country today.
Yes, you're right, and I thank you for that very generous statement. It does have resonance. I tried not to harp on that. I touch on it a few times, and especially at the end in a chapter called Legacy, of what the sort of the lasting effects of that generation has been. And obviously they're now, all of them, of course, are now completely American, or as many, some moved to Israel after the war. But the ones who remain here are indistinguishable from any other Americans, except that many of them, of course, are still Jewish, or their children are, or their grandchildren. And of course, the first generation is pretty much gone now. It was my parents or your parents' generation who passed away. There's still, I think, the last I saw, there were still something like 50,000 Holocaust survivors living in New York City. But of course, Holocaust survivors was mainly people who had been in the camps. and came after the war. The generation before the war, like my parents and your parents, they're, of course, all gone.
That's true. And in a sense, that we're talking about a vanishing population, but one which is not dissimilar in the experiences that it underwent coming here from those of Latinos who are trying to reach our borders today. You talk about the extreme difficulty of the German Jewish population and in the Eastern European Jewish population in trying to break through the very restrictive immigration laws of the United States, which were designed to keep people out.
Yes.
Which were designed to keep people like us out. And
that's absolutely true. And not only were the laws designed that way, the big ones were passed in 1924, the national origins quota laws designed to keep Southern and Eastern Europeans and Asians out. But at the period that we're talking about, there was so much latent, or maybe not even latent, but specific anti-Semitism and xenophobia and nativism in the administration of those laws that the quotas were for Jews or for Hitler refugees were never filled. So that there was a quota, but the whole State Department bureaucracy admitted many fewer than the quotas, the legal quotas allowed. And that's become, of course, a famous story in its own right, is to what extent could FDR have been more more liberal about allowing the admission of Hitler refugees.
Now, the Aufbau told that story, too, did it not?
Yes, yes, they did. They told it. And, of course, there was always, and you may remember this from your own youth, that so many of those people said, Hitler was our, you know, of course, my parents, we all were designated as enemy aliens.
Yes.
And people said, how can I be an enemy alien when Hitler is after me, when I'm the most vehement anti-Nazi you could find? How are they doing this to me? And then there were even people, anyway, there was just a lot of frustration about that. And, of course, that was true in Europe as well, for Jews.
Well, during the time of the migration of German Jewish refugees to the United States and around the entire planet, there was a degree of anti-Semitism in America, which really had disappeared until some expressions of it in very, very recent times, when we thought it really had practically disappeared. And I remember,
yes,
as a child being taken to places, to resorts in New Hampshire, where at the parking lot there were signs that simply said, no Jews allowed.
Yes, yes. And, of course, there was an area in Queens, in New York, in Forest Hills, where many apartments were restricted and would not rent to Jews.
Yeah, and one actually hears of landlords in New York City who applied the same restrictions to other minority groups in a much later period, in the 70s or 80s.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, absolutely. And it, I mean, this has been a thread through our history going back to the beginning. There's been that streak of nativism and resistance to, even though we call ourselves a country of immigrants, there was always resistance, some streak of resistance to immigrants of one kind or another. You know, no Irish need apply, you know, you name it, and all those things.
Now, on the cover of The World of Aufbau, there's a photograph of Albert Einstein taking the oath of citizenship along with a few other people.
Including his daughter, by the way, and his secretary,
who flanked
him. Yes, yes. Anyway, go ahead.
One of the proudest moments of any German Jewish refugee was the moment at which they became citizens of the United States. And
yes.
I noticed that in your own case, that didn't take place until the year you graduated from college.
That's correct. That you're absolutely right. And
now, why is that?
You know, We didn't come as immigrants. We came, it's a long and complicated story, but we came first on a transit visa. We were going to go to Mexico. That's where we were headed. I mean, theoretically, I'm not sure we ever intended to, but we could not get any kind of immigration visa to the U.S. And so we got a transit visa, which was then later changed to a visitor's visa. And then we immigrated to the U.S. in 1947, and we actually had to go to Montreal to pick up our immigrant visa. So I didn't officially immigrate to the U.S. until 1947, about 6 years after we first arrived in this country, and when I was already in high school.
That's an interesting example of how complicated the whole citizenship issue
it was.
German Jews. And then I never realized until this moment that you were actually a foreign student at Amherst College.
Well, I'm not sure I was ever regarded as a
okay,
I'm not sure.
You wouldn't have been, but technically.
I don't think anybody ever called me that, but I guess technically I was. Oh, my goodness. Maybe they had a quota for foreign students. Anyway.
Very possible. I can say that I was in the class of 59, 6 years after you.
Yeah.
And that is a metaphor for the fact that you have been ahead of me in every possible way, except for the fact that I was naturalized quite a bit earlier than you were, although I was somewhat younger. I became a citizen in May of 1945, just after VE Day, the day of the surrender of the
Germans. What a nice way to celebrate.
Yeah, and I vividly recall that I wasn't naturalized on my own, but on my parents' papers, and the judge at the federal courthouse in Philadelphia asked me all the relevant questions as an 8-year-old. I couldn't actually sign my name. I hadn't learned cursive, so I just made an X. But he asked me whether I had ever served in the army of a foreign power, whether I had ever engaged in prostitution, and all kinds of other questions.
He asked you all those questions?
Disease. Yes, and my father told me how to answer. So that was a memorable day in my life, for sure.
That's what a lovely story. And you were 8 years old, and that's wonderful.
Well,
anyway,
I think he was trying to get a laugh from an audience of refugees who were prepared to do anything he suggested. Have you thought much about the intended audience for your book?
Well, I think you touched on it earlier when you said it has relevance to a lot of things that are going on today. And obviously, at this point in the state of our politics, more so than ever because of, I mean, all of the xenophobia and the nativism and the racism that's there now. And perhaps and more so in Europe, I think. That's a part of that same story. Though it's a little bit different, but has some similarities. But here,
it's
obviously
a worldwide phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think right now there's a couple of things. One is obviously I'd like to provide a little bit of background to the grandchildren of my parents or your parents' generation, my kids. And it was interesting. I inscribed a copy of the book to my son who lives not far from us here in California, and it was inscribed to him and his wife and his three kids. And when David was here the last time, he said, "I hope you inscribe a copy for each of the kids." And I thought that was maybe not so intended, but that was a little bit of an answer to your question. I mean, I hope it will be of some use, some interest to the third generation. And then, of course, to address to remind people of parallel events in the past that we should be embarrassed about.
Yep. In that connection, I want to go back to one observation you made earlier, which is that the Aufbau came to be used in the immediate aftermath of World War II as a resource for tracing people who either had reappeared or had disappeared into
yes.
into the camps. And I, that's what I most vividly remember about my parents as readers of Aufbau, which came into our house regularly until probably about 1948 or 1950. The first thing they did was to scan those pages where someone had resurfaced from a displaced persons camp or somewhere around the world and was looking for relatives or friends. And that kind of networking, which could be done so efficiently today, electronically, had to be done painstakingly by reading the small print of the Aufbau.
That's right.
Back in that day. And yet it led to many rediscoveries of people who had been thought to have been lost, or the closing of the book on the knowledge of the lives of people who were no longer going to be with us. So it played a very important role as a center of information in that respect, quite aside from its journalistic accomplishments and the writings of people like Einstein and Thomas Mann and the other notables who contributed to its pages.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. And there was a couple of people observed it was a hometown paper in the classic American sense to that whole generation of immigrants. And there was actually one very touching thing, which was a letter. I'm trying to remember exactly the details. It was a letter from an army officer, Jewish army officer to Aufbau, saying, I hope you will take note of the fact that I've just been commissioned as second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. Normally the army sends routine news releases to the hometown papers of the newly commissioned officers, but since you're my hometown paper, I hope, because I have no other, I hope you'll take note of it.
That's a wonderful line.
Yeah.
That it was a hometown paper for people who didn't have a hometown.
That's right, exactly. And anyway, who no longer had one, or certainly yes, absolutely. Anyway, it was. I found that whole thing, and of course, when it was first at its heyday, I didn't want to have anything to do with anything German, and I'm sure there were many people in my generation who had the same. We were at war with Germany. The Nazis had basically tried to destroy us, so we didn't want to have anything to do with German or the German language. And there was a lot of debates in Aufbau, in fact, about that, about how German could you be. And so there was a real question about identity. And over time, many German refugees would think of themselves as Europeans rather than as Germans, or as originally German. And I think one of the effects that whole generation had was in encouraging the creation of a European community, in essentially as a way of course, of damping down the nationalism that led to two world wars, and to create something greater than the sort of provincial nationalistic European cultures.
I think that's right. Peter, I want to thank you for writing this book, which is a window on a world that was very vivid and interesting and promising and also tragic, and that has largely disappeared in many ways for the better, but in other ways there are aspects of it that we'll miss, but which you have brought back to life. Thank you so much.
I want to thank Werner, by the way, for agreeing to do this, and I'm honored that he did it, and I really appreciate it.